Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, April 16th, 2021. Here are some of your headlines. President Joe Biden labels gun violence in the U.S. an epidemic and says it stains our character and pierces the very soul of our nation. This after Thursday night's mass shooting at a FedEx shipping center in Indianapolis. Police still not releasing any motive. The shooter killing 8 people before apparently killing himself. President Biden also has his first face-to-face meeting with a world leader as the Japanese prime minister visits the White House, China a prominent topic on the agenda. A dedication ceremony for a national World War I memorial in Washington, D.C. The only major war of the 20th century till this point without a memorial in the nation's capital. From the Indianapolis Star Tribune, Indianapolis police said this morning that they have not made a positive identification of the gunman who killed 8 people before taking his own life late Thursday at a FedEx facility in Indianapolis. The Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department Deputy Chief Craig McCart said investigators have an idea of who the man is, but will not reveal a name until positive identification is made by investigators and the coroner. FBI agent in charge Paul Keenan said investigators were searching a home this morning. McCart also gave a brief description of the shooter's actions.
What we did find preliminarily from the interviews that were conducted was that, this suspect came to the facility, and when he came there, he got out of his car and pretty quickly started some random shooting outside the facility. There was no confrontation with anyone that was there. There was no disturbance. There was no argument. He just appeared to randomly start shooting, and that began in the parking lot, and then he did go into the building, into the facility for a brief period of time before he took his own life.
Indianapolis Deputy Police Chief Craig McCart. Several people also wounded in Thursday night shooting, including 5 taken to the hospital. FedEx prohibits employees from having their phones with them while they're working. McCart saying employees not having the phones did not affect police response time, but may have added to frustration and confusion at a family unification site set up at a nearby hotel. In Washington, D.C., President Joe Biden ordering flags be lowered to half staff at the White House and public buildings, noting it had just been 2 weeks since he last gave that order because of another mass shooting. The president was asked a question on this during a joint news conference at the White House in the Rose Garden with the visiting Japanese prime minister. Question from the Associated Press White House reporter Amir Mahani.
Thank you, Mr. President, and thank you, Mr. Prime Minister. Mr. President, in your last press conference, you said successful presidents prioritize and that you were focusing your agenda on one thing at a time. And I'd like to just ask you, what would you say to many of Americans who voted for you about the legislative progress on gun control and police reform, having to wait while you pursue infrastructure? Given that we continue to see these incidents with mass shootings and also police-involved shootings, including the incident that a lot of us saw in Chicago most recently, do you feel any need to reprioritize your agenda?
I've never not prioritized this. No one has worked harder to deal with the violence used by individuals using weapons than I have. I'm the only one ever to have passed an assault weapons ban. I'm the only one that ever got a 10-year ban on assault weapons and clips of more than 10 bullets. Immediately upon us becoming in office, having an attorney general, I asked him to put together the things I could do by executive order, including dealing with new guns that can be made, you can buy in pieces and put together, and other initiatives. I strongly support the universal background checks, which I continue to push. The Congress has to step up and act. The Senate has to act. And I strongly support and continue and never stop supporting the ban on assault weapons and magazines that hold more than 10 bullets. It doesn't mean that I can't also be working at the same time on the economy and on COVID. But it's not a question of my being able to set the agenda in the Senate as to what they will move to first. And so I continue and I strongly urge my Republican friends in the Congress who even refused to bring up the House-passed bill to bring it up now. This has to end. It's a national embarrassment. It is a national embarrassment what's going on. And it's not only these mass shootings that are occurring. Every single day, there's a mass shooting in the United States if you count all those who were killed out in the streets of our cities and our rural areas. It's a national embarrassment and must come to an end. And one last thing, the folks who own weapons, the folks who own guns, they support universal background checks. The majority of them think we should not be selling assault weapons. Who in God's name needs a weapon that can hold 100 rounds or 40 rounds or 20 rounds? It's just wrong. And I'm not going to give up till it's done.
President Joe Biden at the White House. Republican Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri was interviewed today by Washington Post reporter Jacqueline Alamany and was asked to respond specifically to the mass shooting Thursday night in Indianapolis and the call from the president and many congressional Democrats for a federal legislative response to curb gun violence.
I think we do need to wait and see what the causes were and if there were any current laws that were violated or any laws that could have been put in place that would have prevented this. That is often not the case. Remember the terrible Sandy Hook shooting. The shooter and his mother had apparently done everything the law would require, and you don't solve that by changing laws or adding laws. So let's see. The one thing we know for sure is that anybody who participates in this kind of heinous act really has a significant individual problem. You know, the efforts that we've made, Senator Stabenow and I have worked closely together on a package we put together a decade ago, almost now, called Excellence in Mental Health. The more we can do to empower police, empower first responders, have 24/7 accessibility, treat mental health like all other health, that's one way to deal with a number of these problems. And we'll see what the facts are before we decide if there's any law that would have prevented this from happening. But it's a tragedy every time it happens. And again, people in Indianapolis and around the country are sharing in that tragedy.
We do know, though, that there has been some gun legislation passed by the House that would address and potentially have prevented previous mass shootings from happening. Do you support the House passed bill that would require background checks for all gun buyers and extend the time that the FBI has to vet those flagged by the National Instant Check System?
Well, I'm not opposed to looking at things like background checks and red flag laws and other things. I'm not at all sure that any of this legislation would have prevented the events that have already occurred. That has not been the case in the past. I'd have to look carefully at the facts in the House legislation. My guess is that actually it probably wouldn't have prevented the actions that occurred. And one of the things I think we ought to look at here before we rush to find a solution is would it really have solved the problem? So I'm going to be looking at that, have been looking at that. If there are things that we can do that would make a difference here, certainly we ought to be talking about what those are.
Senator Roy Blunt, Republican from Missouri, on Washington Post Live this Friday. CNN reports starting on March 16th, when eight people were killed at three Atlanta-area spas, the U.S. has had at least 45 mass shootings from California to Washington, D.C. CNN defining a mass shooting as a shooting incident that results in four or more casualties, dead or wounded, excluding the shooter or shooters. The U.S. House of Representatives today passing a bill to require employers in the healthcare and social services industries to develop workplace violence prevention plans. Managing the floor debate on the side of the Democratic majority, Joe Courtney from Connecticut.
I am sure that every member in this chamber at some point has tweeted, issued statements, held up signs, thanking nurses, EMTs, doctors, and many other caregivers for their amazing work. But as all those brave workers can attest, there is a second colliding epidemic that they continue to face, namely frightening levels of violence at rates that far exceed those faced by any other sector in our economy. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, which has studied this alarming phenomenon, found that 73% of all violent incidents that happen in American workplaces happen to healthcare and social assistance employees. Year after year, BLS tallies tens of thousands of violent incidents which could be prevented by the standard required by today's legislation. Today, we have the power right here in this chamber to prevent this wave of violence by passing H.R. 1195, the Workplace Violence Prevention for Healthcare and Social Service Workers Act. The primary source of this violence comes in the form of assaults, kicking, hitting, spitting, even the use of firearms and other weapons from patients and those who accompany them. H.R. 1195 would require an enforceable workplace violence prevention standard within 42 months after enactment at about 200,000 healthcare centers, not small doctors' offices or clinics. The standard would require that covered employers develop a workplace violence prevention plan that is tailored to the specific conditions and hazard present at each workplace, not a one-size-fits-all mandate.
Congressman Joe Courtney, senior Democrat on the Education and Labor Committee. The committee's ranking Republican, Virginia Fox of North Carolina, opposing this bill.
Ensuring workplace safety for all American workers, especially our nation's caregivers, is an issue of the utmost importance and deserving of a serious and thorough solution. I agree with my colleague, we all appreciate what healthcare workers have done. I do every day, but particularly since we've had COVID. But H.R. 1195 purports to take a responsible approach to the issue of workplace violence, but legislation that results in a rushed and overly prescriptive rule that omits important input from stakeholders and experts while driving up compliance costs for already struggling industries is far from a sensible solution. Yet that is what we're asked to consider today. Workers in the healthcare and social service industries are at an increased risk of workplace violence, with the Bureau of Labor Statistics finding they are 5 times more likely to experience violence in the workplace than workers in other industries. While the threat is real, the response the Democrats are proposing to address the situation to further their own partisan agenda is not grounded in reality. Workplace violence is already a well-recognized hazard by employers and employees in the healthcare and social services industries. According to a 2018 American Hospital Association survey, 97% of respondents indicated they already have workplace violence policies in place.
Congresswoman Virginia Fox, Republican, on the House floor. This bill to create that workplace violence prevention program for the healthcare industry and social services industry passed. The vote was 254 to 166. On the yes side, 38 Republicans joining all Democrats. This bill previously passed the House in 2019, but never came up for a vote in the Senate. Turning to the coronavirus response, the Biden administration announcing a multi-billion dollar federal funding plan to track and fight COVID-19 variants, especially those which may be more prone to spread quickly and be more deadly. Jeff Zients is the White House COVID-19 response coordinator.
Today, we are announcing a $1.7 billion investment to bolster the ability of the CDC and state and local public health departments to monitor, track, and defeat emerging threats. Whether it's COVID-19 variants today or other viruses in the future, through a process known as genomic sequencing. This significant investment, which is made possible due to the American Rescue Plan President Biden signed into law last month, is critical in our fight against the new and potentially dangerous variants of COVID-19. Right now, these variants account for nearly half of all COVID-19 cases in the United States. And we need more capacity in our public health system to identify and track these mutations. State and local public health departments are on the front lines of beating back the pandemic, but they need more capacity to detect these variants early on before dangerous outbreaks. This funding will enable CDC and states to do more genomic sequencing as we activate the nation's great research capabilities to detect variants earlier and increase our visibility into emerging threats. This investment will give public health officials the chance to react more quickly to prevent and stop the spread.
Jeff Zients leads the White House COVID-19 response at today's virtual briefing. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention saying the U.S. continues to administer 3 million COVID vaccine shots a day, and currently more than 30% of U.S. adults are fully vaccinated. Nearly half have gotten at least one dose. The CDC Director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, saying an independent advisory panel is going to meet again next Friday to resume deliberating about the use of Johnson & Johnson's coronavirus vaccine. That will mean it will be at least 10 days since federal regulators recommended a nationwide pause on the use of the J&J vaccine due to a small number of cases of extremely rare blood clots in people that receive it. One woman, though, did die. Dr. Walensky asked today about the effect of the extended pause on public confidence.
Caitlin Collins at CNN.
Thanks so much. My question is on the J&J vaccine, since you just announced that the vaccine advisors to the CDC aren't going to meet again until next Friday. That means this pause is now lasting more than a week. So aren't you concerned that the longer this pause lasts, the more damage it does to the reputation of the J&J vaccine and people's willingness to get it?
Dr. Walensky.
Thank you for that question, Caitlin. This was a really meeting that we had with ACIP this week. The independent panel suggested that they needed more data. They needed time to look at both the risk and risk benefit analysis that has been that CDC is actively conducting, as well as to see if any further cases came in. We will meet next Friday. We recognize the critical importance of moving quickly. That's why we will have two unscheduled ACIP meetings in a 10-day period, 14-day period. And so we are moving. And what I would say to the American people is that what we found is really extremely rare cases through our vaccine safety monitoring system, and that we are transparently, this meeting on Friday will be public. People can dial in. We are transparently conveying that science. We've reached out to over 10,000 providers to sort of to ensure that they know what kinds of cases to look for and to do that outreach. And we want to convey to the American public, we have two vaccines that are readily available, the Pfizer and the Moderna, and people should continue to roll up their sleeves to get vaccinated.
CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky. Wall Street Journal reports that Johnson & Johnson privately asked rival vaccine makers AstraZeneca, Moderna, and Pfizer to join the company in its effort to evaluate blood clot risks in its coronavirus vaccine, and AstraZeneca was the only one to accept the offer. AstraZeneca also has its own reports of blood clots linked to its COVID-19 vaccine. On Wall Street today, the Dow is up 164, closing at another record, 34,200. NASDAQ up 13, S&P up 15. NASA has selected Elon Musk's SpaceX to build spacecraft that would land astronauts on the moon for the first time since the last Apollo mission, according to a source selection document obtained by the Washington Post. Contract worth $2.9 billion. And Musk beating out Blue Origin, that's Jeff Bezos' company, which partnered with aerospace giants Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and Draper. Also beating out defense contractor Dynetics. Washington Today continues in a minute. And welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. 59% in a new poll of Americans approve of President Biden's handling of his job. 39% disapprove. The approval rating for Biden, similar to former Presidents Obama and George W. Bush at this point in their terms, but 20 points higher than former President Trump had. Russia responding to U.S. sanctions announced by President Biden on Thursday by expelling 10 U.S. diplomats, adding 8 U.S. officials to its sanctions list, and restricting activities of U.S. non-governmental organizations Russia says are interfering in Russia's politics. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says while Russia could take painful measures against U.S. interests in Russia, it's not going to immediately move to do that. The White House says there's been some confusion over an order signed by President Biden on the number of refugees allowed to come to the U.S. this year, and that the president does not plan to limit refugees entering the U.S. to a 15,000 cap set by former President Trump, but that the initial goal from President Biden of more than 62,000 may be too ambitious. And a first guilty plea to federal charges in connection with the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. A judge saying John Ryan Schaefer is cooperating with investigators in hope of getting a lighter sentence. Schaefer, described as a heavy metal guitarist with ties to the group Oath Keepers, he's accused of storming the Capitol and spraying police officers with bear spray. Over 370 other people are facing federal charges in that attack January 6th. Washington Post writing, President Biden making a point as he welcomes Japanese Prime Minister to the White House on Friday, using the first in-person visit by a foreign leader to emphasize his administration sees Asia as its highest priority. The coveted first invitation, intended to reward a strategic ally who was buffeted by transactional and sometimes capricious treatment under President Donald Trump, and to send a signal to China that Biden plans to firm up America's Asian alliances. That was the reporting and analysis by the Washington Post. The two leaders held a joint news conference in the White House Rose Garden, both talking about China. First, President Biden.
Today, Prime Minister Suga and I affirmed our ironclad support for U.S.-Japanese alliance and for our shared security. We committed to working together to take on the challenges from China and on issues like the East China Sea, the South China Sea, as well as North Korea, to ensure a future of a free and open Indo-Pacific. Japan and the United States are two strong democracies in the region, and we're committed to defending and advancing our shared values, including human rights and the rule of law. We're going to work together to prove that democracies can still compete and win in the 21st century. We can deliver for our people in the face of a rapidly changing world. So today, we're announcing a new competitive and reliance partnership, CORE, between Japan and the United States that will enhance our ability to meet the pressing challenges of our time. Together, meet those challenges.
President Biden in the White House Rose Garden. The visiting Japanese Prime Minister spoke through an interpreter.
We also had serious talks on China's influence over the peace and prosperity of the Indo-Pacific and the world at large. We agreed to oppose any attempts to change the status quo by force or coercion in the East and South China Seas, and intimidation of others in the region. At the same time, we agreed on the necessity for each of us to engage in frank dialogue with China and, in so doing, to pursue stability of international relations while upholding universal values.
The Japanese Prime Minister in the White House Rose Garden. President Biden plans to invite to South Korean President Moon Jae-in next month. For the first time since 1959, Cuba is going to have a government without a Castro leading it. First there was Fidel Castro, and then in 2011, his brother Raul. Today, Raul Castro, 90 years old, stepping down as first secretary of the Communist Party of Cuba as the party begins its 8th Congress. Some reaction from the White House and Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
Trevor, I'm sorry, I missed you. Go ahead.
No, there's kind of a historic moment that's playing out in Cuba in terms of Castro stepping down from the Communist Party, mm-hmm. and a changing of the guard in terms of the Castro family moving on in new leadership. Do you have any reaction to that, and why haven't we seen anything from the president as far as sanctions are concerned?
Well, broadly speaking, our policy as it relates to Cuba is going to be governed by two principles. Support for democracy and human rights will be at the core of our efforts through empowering the Cuban people to determine their own future. And second, our belief that Americans, especially Cuban Americans, are the best ambassadors for freedom and prosperity. A Cuba policy shift or additional steps is currently not among the president's top foreign policy priorities, but it is an issue, of course, we will remain engaged in and focused on. And I can see if there's more of a reaction to the change in leadership. Absolutely.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki during her daily briefing. Replacing Raul Castro as the leader of Cuba will be the current Cuban president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, who is 60 years old. As it turns out, Saturday is the 60th anniversary of the Bay and Pigs invasion, when 1,500 Cuban exiles trained by the CIA tried and failed to overthrow then-leader Fidel Castro. This weekend, C-SPAN's Washington Journal and American History TV looks back on the invasion and its consequences. One of the programs is a speech by President John F. Kennedy to the American Society of Newspaper Editors just a few days after, April 20th, 1961. Here's a portion.
This is not the first time in either ancient or recent history that a small band of freedom fighters has engaged the armor of totalitarianism. It is not the first time that communist tanks have rolled over gallant men and women fighting to redeem the independence of their homeland. Nor is it by any means the final episode in the eternal struggle of liberty against tyranny anywhere on the face of the globe, including Cuba itself. Mr. Castro has said that these were mercenaries. According to press reports, the final message to be relayed from the refugee forces on the beach came from the rebel commander when asked if he wished to be evacuated. His answer was, "I will never leave this country." That is not the reply of a mercenary. He has gone now to join in the mountains countless other guerrilla fighters who are equally determined that the dedication of those who gave their lives shall not be forgotten, and that Cuba must not be abandoned to the communists. And we do not intend to abandon it either.
You can hear President John F. Kennedy's full speech from April 1961, a few days after the failed Bay and Pigs invasion, and other programming related to the 60th anniversary of that event this weekend on C-SPAN's American History TV and Washington Journal. You can find the full schedule at our website, cspan.org. A flag-raising ceremony today at a new World War I memorial in Washington, D.C. An article in the New York Times reads, as the United States withdraws from its longest war, referring to Afghanistan, a memorial that recognizes one of its most complicated ones officially opens in Washington on Friday. After years of tangling among preservationists, urban planners, federal officials, and the commission that realized its creation, the first flag-raised memorial in Pershing Park near the White House, rather than along the National Mall where many supporters had envisioned. Dan Dayton is executive director of the World War I Centennial Commission. He spoke during today's ceremony.
The National World War I Memorial is a depiction of what happened 100 years ago when soldiers boarded ships bound for France, determined to bring to a close what they thought would be a war to end all wars. By themselves, they, of course, couldn't end all war. But their courage and sacrifice did indeed bring a decisive end to a conflict that had killed millions. Today's First Colors ceremony is designed to bring our history home. It's a journey that began with an American flag that first flew over our nation's capital on April 6, 2017, commemorating the centennial of the date that the United States went to war. The colors have since flown over the American World War I battlefield cemeteries of Europe, honoring the doughboys who gave their all during the war, and over the National World War I Museum and Memorial in Kansas City. And now they've returned home here to their final destination, where they'll take their rightful place, flying high in perpetuity right here above the new National World War I Memorial in Washington, D.C.
Dan Dayton is executive director of the World War I Centennial Commission at today's flag-raising ceremony. The memorial's main feature is a wall with 58-foot bronze sculpture still to be completed. It will be titled A Soldier's Journey, telling the story of one American's path from a reluctant service member to a returning war hero through a series of scenes featuring 38 figures. That sculpture expected to be done in 2024. Nearly 5 million Americans fought overseas in World War I. More than 116,000 never made it home. Today's ceremony also included a flyover of F-22 fighter jets. Well, thanks for joining us on Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And download the free C-SPAN Radio app to listen anywhere. I hope you have a good night and a good weekend.